Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign was one of the most organized and modern campaigns ever conducted. In a pre-cell phone age, the campaign had ground-to-air phones connecting the plane that candidate Richard Milhouse Nixon would ride in with the New York office he would command from the air. The plane had first-class seats and a Xerox machine that could receive radio signals, an airborne teletype machine, kind of an early fax system. Walkie-talkies were everywhere in the campaign, connecting the presidential campaign workers with each other. The location of the candidate was always known. His words were written down, his movements planned well in advance, by people who would soon become members of the Nixon administration: Bob Hadelman, Maurice Stans, John Ehrlichman, professional men who ran businesses and New York law firms. New York was in the house, and Manhattan was running the show. Bob Hadelman would guard the candidate Nixon with his life. Nobody got to Nixon, no piece of paper got to Nixon unless it was crucial to winning. It had all the marks of a man who had lost before, who in 1960 was surprised by a bright and resurgent Democrat who continuously surprised him and didn't want to let it happen again. In 1960, Nixon had run a 50-state campaign, a nice gimmick, but an exhausting waste of time. Now the campaign was not foolish. They spent time only on the swing states that mattered in this election. In 1960, Nixon had drifted off message. Now he was always on. In 1960, he was a bit arrogant, a bit bitter, where Kennedy seemed happy. Now, in a time of social strife over the Vietnam War, a time when Americans were upset and scared, Nixon seemed the happy one. When the double whammy of protest that could feel huge numbers in the streets and a lack of control where crime and riots in inner cities gripped America, the assassination of major leaders, Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, in one year, when it all just added to the easiness in this election, Richard Milhouse Nixon was the confident, smiling, reassuring face reaching out to the middle class, the so often referred to common man, reaching a hand to the solid South that was turning Republican in the 60s. Nixon now, and Nixon's the one, sign said. Confident slogans. There was reason to be confident, too. Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic nominee and the vice president, anointed in the strange and chaotic convention of Chicago, was struggling. He had just above 30% of the vote, a pathetic number for a national candidate. Coming out of the convention, he first praised Mayor Daley and the Chicago police, then wavered and said perhaps the police had gone too far. It seemed that nobody liked him. He had just 20% of the white male vote and was losing some of the more conservative Democrats to Wallace or perhaps Nixon. But on the other hand, anti-war protesters were angry about their treatment in Chicago and Humphrey's seeming complacency with it. They heckled him at rally after rally, shouting, "Dump the hump, dump the hump." The Democratic National Committee was in shambles. Lane Kirkland, who would later become leader of the AFL-CIO, said he avoided the Democratic headquarters that year because he would go in happy and they were so depressed that when he came out, it made him want to cry. Candidates avoid the plagued Humphrey. When he came to Texas, Democratic Governor John Connally said he didn't have time. More of a challenge for Richard Nixon's campaign was George Wallace, the governor of Alabama and a third-party candidate in this election. He threatened to take southern states away from Nixon with his racist appeal and his backlash campaign against civil rights. Wallace's strategy was to win 177 electoral votes from states like Louisiana, Arkansas, Virginia, North Carolina, Missouri, and to turn the election into the House of Representatives. But because of this, Wallace made the Humphrey situation a little better. Due to civil rights position, Humphrey, as an early liberal, He had fought for civil rights in the 1948 convention. His platform plank was responsible for Strom Thurmond and other Dixiecrats from bolting, for bolting that convention. Due to his position, Humphrey had no chance at states like Alabama or South Carolina or Mississippi. But no matter. In this election, Wallace would relieve him of having to win those states. He would take them away from Nixon, take them off the table in this election, make the battle a little bit more of a narrower one for Humphrey. In a way, Wallace helped his ideological nemesis, Humphrey. It was a challenge for the Nixon campaign, and Nixon's campaign focused on Wallace probably more than Humphrey in September. Still, they were confident. "He scares women," one of Nixon's advisors said. Plus, he was pulling Northern Union workers from Humphrey. "Containment," said one Nixon aide, "was the plan. Keep Wallace in just the few southern states that Nixon couldn't beat him in. Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. But keep him out of Missouri, Virginia, or Florida. Nixon needed to win those states, and there he was battling with Wallace, not Humphrey." Nixon's campaign in September was a well-oiled machine. Even in a three-way race, September polls had Nixon at 48%, darn near majority. And then came October. And slowly but surely, something changed. It had to do partially with the actions of Hubert Humphrey, the candidate, but also with events that would be larger than anyone running. Slowly but surely, Humphrey became less of a joke, his message more focused, and he got larger crowds, and his poll numbers rose. Some of this was a dead cat bounce. At 30%, Humphrey had hit rock bottom. He was down so low that he wasn't going to go down farther as the leader and candidate of a national party with a huge following and actually a majority of the registered voters sympathetic to it. He could not stay at 30% for long. Another important impact was that of the work of the AFL-CIO. They sent hundreds of thousands of mail pieces reminding labor union members in the North about George Wallace's anti-union policies and talking about how little bus drivers and other workers in Alabama made. But the biggest change would come from Hubert Humphrey himself. After a disastrous speech in Seattle, in which he was heckled by protesters shouting, "Dump the hump, dump the hump," he could not make his speech. He tried to reach out to the crowd, tried to listen to them. Eventually, the Secret Service had to clear the area. An absolute disaster. Humphrey realized he had to change his policy towards Vietnam and adjust to the new public opinion. President Johnson insisted on a strong backing of his Vietnam policy. Hubert Humphrey knew he had to do something at least slightly different. A speech was arranged in Salt Lake City, and the Democratic National Committee arranged just enough funds, $100,000, to telecast it nationally. Humphrey stayed up till early in the morning, working on his position. He would tell President Johnson about his position only 10 minutes before he would go on stage. When Johnson pressed him for detail, Humphrey said, "Listen to the broadcast." In his Salt Lake City speech, Humphrey would say that he would halt bombing of North Vietnam if the North Vietnamese would stop fighting and would return and resume negotiations with the United States and the South Vietnamese. Humphrey was proud of his position. He felt he was now running as his own man. Wasn't exactly what President Johnson wanted, but it wasn't withdrawal from Vietnam either. Within 48 hours, a flood of letters, 5,000 letters, came to Democratic headquarters. And money came too, $250,000 in donations. By October 10th, $1 million would come in. New York and Maryland McCarthy groups, those who were running against the Vietnam War. McCarthy was the first candidate to challenge Lyndon Johnson. They now endorsed Hubert Humphrey. By mid-October, Humphrey went up 6 points, and the race was now 44% to 36%. Humphrey was still in a losing position, but he was gaining on Nixon. National Democrats who had fled their candidate now came back home. John Connally, governor of Texas, who had no time for Humphrey the last time, amazingly found time to hold a rally in Texas now. At the same time, some of Nixon's charm was lost. Americans had heard his speeches for a while now, and they seemed canned, while the feisty Humphrey attacked Nixon with new vigor. "Who can you trust?" he said. "What has Nixon done for seniors? What has he done for working people?" And then Humphrey called for a TB debate. When Nixon refused, and Nixon of course would refuse, his campaign realized he was the front runner, and Nixon felt that he had lost the 1960 campaign to Kennedy when he agreed to a TB debate. So when Nixon refused, Humphrey's campaign called him Sir Richard the Chicken-Hearted. Nixon's campaign began to feel things changing a bit, but there was no panic. This was still a business operation. And so Nixon planned a counterstrike, a series of broadcasts on radio in order to show his substance. Each broadcast would be on a different issue. Then they would go after Humphrey. They would attack him, saying his hand was in your pocket, and he was the fastest, loosest tongue in the West. The Nixon campaign was now not the subtle Nixon's the one. The new slogan was vote like your whole life depended on it. A real example of the change that occurred in mentality of the campaign. But then in mid-October, something else happened that would be beyond these two candidates, Nixon and Humphrey. Peace talks, which had been going on for a long time in Paris, now began to bear some fruit. On October 11th, 1968, there was some movement prompted by the Russians. The North Vietnamese agreed that they would let the South Vietnamese participate in the negotiations if the bombing was temporarily halted. And one of the barriers of these early peace talks was that North Vietnamese didn't even want the South Vietnamese at the table because they didn't recognize their government. There was now going to be peace talks, and Lyndon Johnson, the incumbent president, telephoned, of course, his vice president Humphrey, but also the candidate Richard Nixon. Nixon was concerned, but there was little that he could do. By October 26, 10 days before the election, newspapers leaked the first reports that there were talks going on. By the 29th of October, every major news media had the story. And so now, just 5 days before the election, the president moved to center stage. Lyndon Johnson, the president who insisted on a strong stance on Vietnam, who wouldn't allow his vice president, his candidate, to reach out to the anti-war crowd, who even hinted that Nixon's policy might be closer to his views than Humphrey's. Now he was living up to Humphrey's position in a Salt Lake City speech. He said, "I have ordered an end to air, naval, and artillery bombardment of Vietnam as of 8 a.m. Washington time, in the belief that this could lead to progress in peace." It was riveting for the Nixon campaign. One of the major issues on the table, the Democrats had botched up the Vietnam War, and that Richard Nixon, smiling and confident, with a secret plan for the Vietnam War that he couldn't reveal, was the choice for this situation. But now it seemed that the problem may be on the cusp of being solved, and Democrats would certainly be rewarded. In this 2008 election, the fiscal crisis kind of came on the scene in mid-September and seemed sudden and seemed dramatic and, in a sense, almost in and of itself chose a winner and loser in the election. But imagine if such an event had occurred just 5 days before, and that made this election of 1968 really a final day's election. Over the weekend, some polls were showing Hubert Humphrey at 40% and Nixon at 42%. But then, the peace negotiations would be stalled over the weekend. The South Vietnamese had initially agreed to the talks, and that gave Lyndon Johnson enough confidence to take the airways with his statement. But it turned out it was only the president of South Vietnam that had given his approval. The Assembly and Senate had not. And several important senators came out over the weekend against the talks. There were then rumors that Anna Chenault, a Nixon committee person with some ties to the South Vietnamese government and some of these senators, had gotten involved in the peace talks. That would have been traitorous. President Johnson heard that the votes of 11 senators might have been switched by this particular woman. He was furious. Nixon denied any involvement and ensured his campaign would investigate it. All attention went then to Hubert Humphrey. And as many in the Nixon campaign at the time described, their entire presidential hopes then rested on the goodwill of Hubert Humphrey. If he turned towards the Nixon campaign and raised the matter of this Nixon committee woman who may have been involved in undoing American foreign policy, he might have easily won the election. In fact, the Nixon people were sure of it. But Hubert Humphrey never wavered from the belief that if Richard Nixon was aware of such a thing, he would not have condoned it, that this had nothing to do with the Nixon campaign, and therefore he wouldn't go out and make a statement about it. There have been few elections in American history that were so determined by the actions in the final days, and fewer elections where we have polling data that shows the ups and the downs of the various candidates. Hubert Humphrey went from having no chance of victory in September to closing in on Richard Nixon to an easy statistical dead heat in November. 73 million voters would come out, 31,770 for Nixon, 31,270 for Humphrey. Enormously close result. 302 electoral votes for Nixon, 191 for Humphrey. But that electoral vote total belies how close the battle in some of those states were, with many, many states coming in with just a margin of less than 5% between the two candidates. Americans love the underdog, and so the story of the 1948 campaign, in which Harry Truman, virtually all in the month of October, changed the momentum of his presidential reelection race and won the election from Thomas E. Dewey, defying all national political experts. That's always on our minds in American politics. It keeps American political races exciting at all times. Even though we are close to Election Day now, there's still always the chance that John McCain can come back. The Republicans can turn this thing around. Why? Because we can point to elections like 1948. Another example of an election that was won in the final days, perhaps, is 1916. Although there weren't polls to really measure the action, Woodrow Wilson won that election by just about 10,000 votes in California, out west. Still one of the most vibrant and sometimes forgotten examples of a campaign that was really decided, where a lot of the action was in the last days, was 1968. That's why I used it mostly as an example today. But this example also shows two things, that the actions of candidates certainly are important, but it really is events which intervene and determine political campaigns and how they're going to go. An incumbent party owning the White House always has some control over these events, but not total control, as Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey would find out. It's a worthwhile reminder as we approach the last days of this campaign. With history beating up politics, I'm Bruce Carlson.